Tax Update for Wednesday, July 4th, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for Wednesday, July 4th, 2007. This week, the value of standards. Statements on standards for valuation services number one bursts on the scene. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we're going to take a look at the release of a new set of standards applicable to CPAs, but which also may be of interest if you are another tax professional, an attorney or an EA, who works with CPAs on tax matters where valuation of items or valuations of certain interests become an issue. Because CPAs are going to be facing new standards effectively January 1st that will govern their ability and the services they render with regard to any sort of valuation engagement. And because you need to be concerned about that, and they're going to be concerned about the issue of whether or not these standards apply and what they have to do if they do, it probably is important for anyone in the tax arena to be aware of where these standards come down and how they work. Now, for those of you looking for it, the AICPA currently has them published on their website. And if you go to basically my site, where the Libsyn site, which will have the link, or the Lineberg Services site that has the link on this podcast, to the documents for this podcast, there is a link in there. It's kind of long and involved, where the AICPA has the actual text of this standard available. And I would suggest you go grab that text as well, especially if you're a CPA, because these standards are going to become important. The standards in question are issued by the Consulting Services Executive Committee of the AICPA. And as such, the Consulting Services Executive Committee is one of the committees recognized by the AICPA Council to promulgate enforceable standards. Now, why, you may ask, is that important to you? Well, the reason that's important to you as a CPA, even if you're not a member of the AICPA, is that most states do, directly or indirectly in their regulations, reference that the AICPA Code of Professional Conduct shall be considered an example of, at least, what is considered ethical conduct on the part of CPAs, or the standard CPAs are to basically conform to be in compliance with the state accountancy laws and regulations. Those particular standards in the Code of Professional Conduct has a provision that states that members, and in this case we might as well expand it to say CPAs, shall conform to the standards promulgated by bodies that are recognized by the AICPA Council as issuing such binding guidance. And the Consulting Services Executive Committee is one such organization or committee that's recognized to do such. As such, these standards, which have an effective date for engagements that are entered into after January 1st, 2008, should be considered to be the measuring standard for CPAs. And even if you take the position that these standards are not valid under your state law, for whatever reason you want to talk about, under that theory, you have to face the fact that if you face civil action in this area, probably the attorney for the other side is going to be looking at the issue as to whether or not, you know, did you perform in accordance with what your profession generally says is adequate standards for doing the work. And in this particular case, they are likely to go back to these standards anyway. So you need to be aware of when these standards would have applied and whether they should have been applied. So let's take a look. We'll deal with the issue. What is this and why does it matter? Well, a couple of things. Valuation is an area of specialty for CPAs, and it's an area that, to put it simply, the AICPA has been trying to establish a specialty in for CPAs for quite a while. Due to that fact, there has been a group that's in there for consulting services, and the AICPA has even got a business valuation certificate that you can get, or the standard you can be certified as a business for business valuation. That group has now come up with standards that are meant to be applicable for CPAs doing business valuations Note that these standards apply in addition to any other standards that the CPA may be subject to due to membership in other business valuation organizations. So you apply the higher of this standard or the other standard, whichever ones, you make sure you comply with all of them. Now, SSVS number 1 is the first standard in this set of statements on standards for valuation services. Number 1 implies that we probably will see numbers 2, 3, and 4 at some point, but for right now, we have only the single one to deal with. This one was issued along with an interpretation at the same time. So there's the standard and there is the interpretation we'll deal with. Now, this valuation standard does not apply to valuations of everything. Tax returns often involve valuing certain items, or tax practice does. For instance, you may have to come up with the value of the assets in a charitable remainder trust in order to compute the distribution that will be payable to the beneficiary of the trust. You may need to come up with the value of assets in a pension or profit sharing plan to allocate the loss or income among the participants in the plan. You may need to value the plan in order to use for a computation for funding for a defined benefit plan. So there are lots of times in tax values where we need to worry about that. You may be worried about it when we're talking about Section 108 and the question of, was the taxpayer insolvent under 108? Well, that involves obviously valuing the assets of the taxpayer. SSVS number 1 does not apply to all such engagements that involve with value. There are only a limited set of engagements that it will apply to. And in fact, it will apply to engagements that are meant to value one of four items that are reproduced on page 3 of our materials. And the valuations will apply to the value of a business ownership interest, a security, or an intangible asset. Now, these four items are defined. Two of the items are defined by reference to the International Glossary of Business Valuation Terms. Those are definitions that have been agreed to by the AICPA, the American Society of Appraisers, the Canadian Institute of Chartered Business Valuators, the National Association of Certified Valuation Analysts, and the Institute of Business Appraisers. Two other of the definitions are internal for this document only. The document contains two appendices. Appendix B has the IGBVT valuation items, the ones that have been agreed to. Appendix C has the ones that are specific for SSVS number 1. Let's go to the first item for which it will count. That'll be a class called a business. And it uses the definition of what is a business enterprise from the IGBVT. And that calls a commercial, industrial, service, or investment entity, or combination thereof, pursuing an economic activity. Now, this talks about the value of the business itself. A second related item is a business ownership interest. This does not have a definition in the IGBVT, but is defined internally for this particular standard as a designated share in the ownership of a business or business enterprise. So we have the business, and then we have an ownership portion of that business. That will also count for purposes of having to conform to these standards. So if we value the entire business, or if there's a valuation of an ownership interest in that business, these standards could apply. The third thing it can apply to is a security from Appendix C. And according to the definition here, which is the Appendix C is the definitions for which is internal to this document, that is a certificate evidencing ownership or the rights to ownership in a business enterprise that, one, is represented by an instrument or by a book record or contractual agreement, two, is of a type commonly dealt on a securities exchanges or markets, or, when represented by an instrument, is commonly recognized in any area in which it is issued or dealt in as a medium for investment, and three, either one or a class of or series or by its items is divisible into a class or series of shares, participations, interests, rights, or interest-bearing obligations. So that's the definition of a security. If we are valuing in a security, then again, this may apply. Finally, an intangible asset. This again comes from the International Glossary of Business Valuation Terms definition, and it talks about non-physical assets such as franchises, trademarks, patents, copyrights, goodwills, equities, mineral rights, securities, and contracts as distinguished from physical assets that grant rights and privileges and have value for the owner. Now, as you may notice, these four definitions are not mutually exclusive. There is overlap among the group. But in general, if it falls into one of these four areas and there is a value attached, we may have to deal with compliance with SSVS number one. And as you might note initially, you're thinking that's a pretty broad class of things it could apply to. The SSVS internally, as you read it, will refer to these four classes as subject interest. By definition, that's an asset that falls into one or more of these categories. So if a CPA has a tax engagement and a valuation of an asset comes into play, the first question the CPA is going to have to ask is, does my asset fall into one of these four categories, or we should say one or more of these four categories? If it does, then we have to go to the next step to see whether we have to apply SSVS number one, because it's not automatic that all assets that fall into these categories will require the application of SSVS number one. But it does mean we've cleared the first hurdles. Now, if a subject interest is involved, then the question is going to be the activity a CPA is engaged to perform that's going to trigger the application of these standards, which provide performance, documentation, and communication requirements to the CPA. Because all three of those are required standards or required steps the CPA must take, if these standards are triggered, it's going to have an impact on the amount of work the CPA must do, and conversely, we would expect it to have an impact on the fee that will be charged by the CPA to perform these services. As was noted from this quotation from the standard that we quote at the beginning of our materials here, the standard applies when a CPA is engaged to estimate the value of a subject interest. The standard defines such an engagement as below. As described in this statement, the terms engagement to estimate value refers to an engagement or any part of an engagement. For example, tax, litigation, or acquisition-related engagement that involves estimating the value of a subject interest. And this is from SSVS number one, the second paragraph. It's important to note that that definition specifically states that a tax engagement potentially may fall under the scope of SSVS number one. The standard goes on to note the following. An engagement to estimate values culminates in the expression of either a conclusion of value or a calculated value. These are important because these are the two types of reports, and they fall into the two types of engagements and performance standards a CPA may need to comply with if the standard applies. Those that come to a conclusion as to value will be referred to as valuation engagements under the standard. Those that come up with what's called a calculated value are calculation engagements. And it notes, a valuation engagement requires more procedures than does a calculation engagement. And the valuation engagement results in a conclusion of value. The calculation engagement results in a calculated value. The standard notes that the understanding with the client determines the type of engagement involved, whether it's a valuation engagement or a calculation engagement. Obviously, this leads to the standards that define what is required in that understanding and how it must be documented. You must have an understanding with your client, and SSVS number 1's paragraph 16 and 17 deal with that. A CPA who fails to recognize that they've triggered this standard may find a number of presumptions that they're not going to like apply to the type of engagement that it will be presumed they have been engaged to perform where the documentation of a specific understanding doesn't exist or is inadequate. So obviously, it will be strongly preferred that if you have such an engagement, you get the agreement in writing, and you specifically address the matters that are discussed in paragraph 16 and 17 of SSVS number 1. So let's take a look at the two types of engagements. Let's start first with the more complicated valuation engagement. A valuation engagement, because it is the most involved, is the one that's going to presumptively be the engagement you were supposed to undertake if it's not clear which one you're going to do. And it's further defined in the standard that we find that a valuation analyst, and that when it reads that, it means the CPA performing the valuation, performs a valuation engagement when the engagement calls for the valuation analyst to estimate the value of a subject interest, and two, the valuation analyst estimates the value as outlined in paragraphs 23 to 45 of the standard and is free to apply the valuation approaches and methods he or she deems appropriate in the circumstances. The valuation analyst expresses the results of the valuation as a conclusion of value. The conclusion may be either a single amount or a range. The key issue in a valuation engagement is the CPA is basically free to apply the approaches and methods that he deems appropriate to determine the value. As would be suggested, if there's not a written understanding, presumption is going to probably be you have a valuation engagement. Paragraphs 23 to 45 detail the information about the methods and types of approaches the CPA would consider and the type of information the CPA's report would contain. Valuation engagements may result in either a detailed report or a summary report. Now, a CPA may be exempted from reporting, but not the performance portion of SSVS number 1 in certain legal proceedings. For that, see SSVS number 1, paragraph 50. So again, remember, these kind of like compilation and review, we have performance standard, we have reporting standards. In the litigation arena, you may be exempted from the reporting, but not the performance standard. Now, again, the choice of report you're going to issue, be it a detailed or summary report, is based on the reporting detail agreed to by the CPA and the client. Again, we would suggest that if there's no agreement, it's going to be presumed you are going to give a detailed report, not a summary report. The use of either of these reports to compute the results of a calculation engagement, we'll get to what that is prohibited by the standard. And that's found in paragraph 48. Now, on page 5 of our materials, we go through a listed that's found at paragraph 51 of the standard of the items you would expect to find in a detailed report. Now, each of these sections is defined in a detailed report to be included as appropriate. A CPA whose report omits one of these items found in paragraph 51 would presumably be saying that, in essence, you know, it's not a needed, or you're going to have to explain why this particular portion was not required in your engagement. Read the standard if you're into the valuation arena. We're not here really to summarize all the valuation rules in detail. We're here to try to understand the basics of when the standard would apply. If you're in the business valuation arena, realize there are detailed standards here to go take a look at and make sure you understand what would be there. While theoretically a detailed report can be oral rather than a written report, that's actually technically allowed in paragraph 47 of SSVS number 1, a CPA that attempts to rely on the claim that he told the client what went on is probably playing a very dangerous game if he's going to rely on the client's memory to decide exactly what was communicated about each of these items. Therefore, a CPA probably shouldn't expect to rely on the lack of a requirement for a written report. In most cases, you'd want a written report. The only reason you're going to fall back on no written report is required is because you just got hung out to dry and now you're basically grasping at straws. I would not want to be on that particular, at that particular point when I'm trying to defend my work if that's the issue that's in front of us. But technically it is not required to be written, so you do have an option to go that route. Now, the more limited summary report may initially sound attractive until you take a look at the list of minimum items to be included, which kind of amusingly is actually longer than the list of items to be in a detailed report. Now, the key difference is, though, these items are provided in much less descriptive. The items that we find in a detailed report require much more description to go with them. These are just a quick summary beginning at paragraph 71, a list of items that should be in the summary report. And, you know, so essentially, but this summary report is not going to be a single statement reference. It goes on through page 8 of our materials here from page 6 through 8. Now, the other alternative we may have is a calculation engagement. This method, that is defined as noted where the valuation analyst and client agree on the valuation approaches and methods the analyst will use and the extensive procedures the analyst will perform in the process of calculating the value of a subject interest. These procedures will be more limited than those of valuation engagement as noted parenthetically. And the valuation analyst calculates the value in compliance with the agreement. The valuation analyst expresses the results of these procedures as a calculated value. The calculated value is expressed as a range or a single amount. A calculated engagement does not include all of the procedures required for a valuation engagement. Key difference here is the CPA is not free to select the various, to use his professional judgment to select the approaches and methods. Rather, we agree on the approaches and methods will be used, and then the CPA basically goes forward and uses his work and does his professional work on under the assumption we're going to use these methods. Now, it's important to note that merely avoiding selecting valuation approaches and methods won't remove an engagement from the standard. It just lowers the requirement somewhat. So if the CPA doesn't select those methods but it's agreed to, that doesn't eliminate the standards. It merely takes them down to a slightly lower level. Paragraph 73 begins a description of a calculation report. It provides, a calculation report is the only report should be used to report the results of a calculation engagement. The report should state that it is a calculation report. Key caveat, that means if it doesn't state, it's a valuation report. The calculation report should include the representation of value analysts similar to that in paragraph 65, but adapted for a calculation engagement. Again, if we don't state what the report is, presumption is it's not a calculation engagement, but a valuation engagement, and the CPA is responsible for selecting the methods used for valuing, the methods and approaches used for the valuation. There's also a list to be that need to be in the calculation report they apply. Again, if they're left out, it's presumably because they don't apply. And that list goes on, as we found in SSVS number 71, for the items we need to have it. That includes things like hypothetical conditions used in the value calculation engagement, including the basis for their use, any application of the jurisdictional exception, we'll talk about that later, and any assumption limiting conditions applicable to the engagement. If the valuation analyst used the work of a specialist, the valuation analyst should describe in the calculation report how the specialist's work was used and the level of responsibility, if any, the valuation analyst is assuming for the specialist's work. The calculation report may also include disclosure of subsequent events in certain circumstances. Thus, if there's no hypothetical condition contained in the valuation in the calculation report, a reader would be able to presume that the conditions are not hypothetical, but rather the expected conditions are the ones the CPA believes exist currently. Finally, there's a list of required items to be in a calculation report. That particular list of items is found at paragraph 76 of the standard, and it goes on and gives us a list of A through K of the items we should have in the engagement. Again, you can go check that on page 9 and 10 of our printed information. Now, those are the two types of reports. There are some types of reports that are excluded automatically. A number of engagements are automatically excluded. The first and key, a test engagements, audit compilations and reviews are excluded. It's not applicable, the statement holds, to a member who participates in estimating the value of a subject interest as part of performing in a test engagement defined by Rule 101 of the AICP Code of Professional Conduct, for example, as part of an audit, review, or compilation engagement. Secondly, if the value is provided to the CPA by another party, including the client, the standard does not apply. That goes on to state in paragraph 6 that the statement is not applicable when the value of subject interest is provided to the member by a client or the third party. So if somebody tells us this is the value, or we have an outside, or the client retains the services of an outside valuation analyst, and that analyst says the value of this is X dollars, then we're not subject to SSVS number 1. Realize, however, we may have performance issues otherwise under either the attest rules or under the tax standards, that we can't turn a blind eye if we have reason to believe the valuation is incorrect. But that's a different set of issues. It's not one that SSVS number 1 is going to trigger. Accountants that are doing a valuation as an employee for an employer's internal use is not required to comply with the standard. But note, the exception would not apply if the accountant was aware the valuation would be used by outsiders like a lender, or if the CPA is deemed to be in public practice. For instance, if you're an industry CPA and you're a controller, you can't presume you could ignore this, because if you go out and moonlight, is the term used in one of the examples, and assist somebody in doing one of these statements, the full statement comes down on you. The mere fact that I'm not really in public accounting and I don't do public accounting, I'm not a member of a CPA firm, will not save you. The standard will apply to you. Economic damage calculations are not covered by the standard unless the termination has an engagement to estimate value contained within it. So merely estimating economic damages will not trigger this particular issue unless there's an underlying asset that is a subject interest that is being valued as part of this engagement. But the actual economic damage valuation by itself is not going to be the subject interest right off. Now, illustration 3 of the interpretation outlines a case where the standard could apply depending upon whether the damages being measured related to a startup business are for lost profits, which are not a problem, or for the loss of value of the business, which would trigger the standard. If we're going to calculate what the presumed value of the business was and a decrease in that value, then we would trigger the standard. Now, key issue here and important, mechanical computations do not trigger the standard. This is found in SSVS number 19, paragraph 9A. The standard is not applicable to a mechanical computations that do not rise to the level of an engagement to estimate value. when the member does not apply valuation approaches and methods and does not use professional judgment. For example, evaluation done by applying a straight mathematical factor from a table with no professional judgment involved, SSVS number 1 is not triggered. That would include as well valuing a small block of publicly traded stock using a market price a single time. Example difference we'll use here. If I have a client who owns 100 shares of Microsoft stock, that's their total holdings in Microsoft, I can value those 100 shares using the market price as of today. However, if my client would happen to be Bill Gates and we're talking about the total the value of his total holdings, then I'm going to have an issue here and the rules are going to be triggered because his shares would no longer be mechanical. We would have to consider the impact of the fact of Bill Gates selling all of his shares, both from the sheer size of the shares, plus all the other impacts that would be expected to occur. In essence, the market price is not a realistic price for his shares. If it is not practical to obtain relevant information, the standard does not apply. That's also an exception found in paragraph 9b. However, CPAs need to be very careful of this one because there's a little footnote that goes with it at the end of the sentence. And that footnote can cause this issue to evaporate. The footnote states, unless prohibited by statute or by rule, a member may use the client's estimates for compliance reporting to a third party if the member determines the estimates are reasonable based on the facts and circumstances known to the member. See interpretation number 1, scope of additional services, the statements on standards for valuation services, and statements on, for standards on tax services number 4. So if, in fact, it's not practical to go detailed to get the information, but the information can be provided by the client and we don't believe that their estimate is relatively reasonable, then we're back to SSVS number 1. It's no longer impractical to perform the engagement. So be careful. Don't presume the practicality exception is going to get you out all the time because it probably won't. There's a limited exception for issues where other authorities conflict with the specific provisions of SSVS number 1. And this exception, though, extends only to the items of conflict. And on all other issues, you're going to have to comply. And this is the jurisdictional issue. If any part of this statement differs from public, governmental, judicial, or accounting authority, or such authority specifies valuation development procedures or valuation reporting procedures, then the valuation analyst should follow the applicable published authority or stated procedures with respect to that part applicable to the valuation in which the member is engaged. Important note at the end, the other parts of this statement continue in full force and effect. See Valuation Services Interpretation number 1. And this is SSVS number 1, paragraph 10, has this particular issue deal with it. Now, this particular standard generated a lot of discussion and concern when it was issued. Many state societies issued comments on this particular standard when it was exposed, as well as the AICPA's tax division, tax section was concerned. One of the changes that was made when we went from exposure draft to the final standard is what was previously a non-authoritative question and answer explanation was revised to become an authoritative interpretation of this standard. So we're going to see that we now have interpretation 101. We have now interpretation number 1 of SSVS number 1. And interpretation number 1 is a series of questions and answers that deal with the application of this standard to specific fact situations. The largest portion of this interpretation deals with application to situations that arise in tax practice. And there are a number of these illustrations that go on for quite a while, beginning with illustration 6. And it comes and discusses the basics that we're going to have to basically, it applies to tax practice. We do not have the exception, which is important to note about illustration number 6, that we have in the statements on standards for accounting review services, where if there's a tax return involved, you basically get a pass on SARs. And you don't have to issue a compilation report, nor are the compilation performance standards triggered under SARs, even though with a corporate tax return, you may have what appears to have all of the elements necessary for a financial statement. The CPA does not hold to the SARs standards. For SSVS number 1, you do not get a pass merely because these things are going on a tax return. That is important to note. Now, Illustration number 7 deals with, well, if we've got to do that, do we have to give a report to the IRS? And illustration number 7 indicates, no, the report always goes to the client. No report is required to be attached to a tax return, even though the valuation was used with the tax return in that case. So we don't have to attach this particular document. Now, this distinction may also explain why the Accounting Review Services Committee felt they had to make a tax return exception for compilation reviews. They're used for third parties. The theory is when the accountant is doing an attest report, the accountant is reporting to third-party users. In the issue for the valuation services, we are reporting to the client. It is the client who gets the report of value from us, and the client may choose to use it. Now, mechanical computations are covered in Illustration 8 when they arise in the performance of a tax return engagement. Now, therefore, mechanical computations in Illustration 8, they go through a number of things that would qualify. That includes computation of remainder interest under a grant using actuarial tables would be a mechanical calculation, not covered. Determining the value of relatively small blocks of stock, a publicly traded stock whose per share price is rarely ascertainable, is not covered. Preparing a tax return using the valuation of a business that was produced by a third-party appraiser or by the client is not covered. And calculating cash holdback requirements for cash tax contingencies is not covered. However, related items that would be covered. Valuing a block of publicly traded stock if the analyst includes consideration of a discount for blockage, lockup, or other contractual or market restrictions, such as the valuation approaches and methods are applied and professional judgment is used to determine the fair value, fair market value, or other applicable standard of value. B. Valuing a stock that is not publicly traded. Closely held stock valuations are always going to trigger these standards. C. Computing the fair market value of assets in a charitable remainder trust if the engagement requires the application of valuation approaches and methods and the use of professional judgment to estimate the fair market value. When would that arise? Presumably if you had a CRT that it was invested in something other than marketable securities, or presumably that block of stock Bill Gates owns ends up owning the CRT, then we have a different issue at that point as well with, you know, having to worry about the valuation of that huge block of stock in the CRT, that if the CRT sold it would cause us some issues with valuation. Now, illustration number 9 deals with the case of, does the jurisdictional exception provide an engagement to estimate value which is not subject to statement if the member determines and reports values using procedures mandated by the Internal Revenue Code, Internal Revenue Service regulations, court case, or published guidance, and other sources of federal, state, and local law solely for purpose of tax return preparation and other tax services? And the conclusion is no, the jurisdictional exception will not exempt engagement from the statement, even if the engagement's sole purpose was to value a subject interest for tax reporting. Only, it points out, the portion of this particular standard that differs from that published guidance is not applicable, but any part that doesn't differ or where the published guidance is silent, you're back to SSVS number 1. Now, illustrations number 10 and 11 will be of interest to CPAs with estate planning or attorneys that work with them, who've come to rely on CPAs for doing some sort of rule of thumb valuation for planning purposes. In illustration 10, we have an interest in a publicly traded partnership whose shares are frequently traded, considered a security. And then it goes as interest in a finally limited partnership or other non-traded partnership considered a security. And it notes that whether something is a security is a legal determination. However, where the value of security is readily ascertainable, the analyst doesn't need to use judgment. So if we have a traded public partnership where there's a market price, we don't have to use professional judgment, the standard would not apply. An interest in a non-publicly traded partnership, such as a flip, it's going to be irrelevant whether it's a security or not, because that particular is a business ownership interest, and the valuation of such non-publicly traded interest requires the application of valuation approaches and methods and the use of professional judgment, and would be subject to SSVS number 1. So the key factor here is to note the partnership interest be a business interest, so a non-publicly traded partnership, and virtually all flips are non-publicly traded. It seems unlikely to have a publicly traded flip. Would generate an entity that would bring the engagement under the results. Now, illustration 11 is a detailed estate planning discussion and illustrates some of the nuances that have to be considered when determining if the standard applies. In this example, the client engages a member to provide advice for planning purposes such as estate planning, personal financial planning, or merger and acquisition planning. The client holds an ownership interest in a family business being operated by a limited liability company, an interest in private real estate limited partnership, publicly traded stock, a personal residence, and a retirement account. Is this a valuation engagement subject to the statement? The answer is it depends. Providing technical advice without reference to the value for the various assets is not subject to the statement. So I can discuss with the client the applications of the tax law to these particular assets or whatever the value might be. Then I could discuss the technical rules. However, if we calculate the value to illustrate the planning option, you may fall under the statement. If one or more of the assets is a business ownership interest, security, or intangible assets, and the client or a third party does not provide the value for those assets, and the member does not use assumed or hypothetical values, now notice you just got two outs here that you could use, the member performing the valuation is subject to the statement regardless of those assets. In this example, the member applies valuation approaches and methods and use professional judgment to determine the value of the ownership interest in a family business or the interest in private real estate limited partnership. In order to provide planning advice, the statement would apply. In contrast, if a client or third party provides those values or we use hypothetical values, then it doesn't apply. In this case, we're going to need to be careful about whether we truly are estimating the value or whether we make it very clear we're using hypothetical values, that we are not telling them that this is the value involved and what's going on here. Now, illustration number 12 is really a whole set of illustrations that deal with tax engagements. It notes that there are many instances where tax engagement involves the need for a member to estimate value. No kidding. The estimation of value may not have been the primary purpose of engagement, rather a task necessary to perform or item to consider when making a tax determination concerning the reporting of a transaction on a tax return. Then it goes on to deal with specific situations, and we have these sub-illustrations. Illustration 12A, we've been engaged to determine deductibility of interest on a non-recourse loan. Under the applicable regulations, interest in a non-recourse loan cannot be deducted if it is clear the company will be unable to service the debt. For purposes of tax reporting, a conclusion must be reached concerning the ability of the company to service the debt. Is this a valuation engagement subject to the statement? The answer is this is not a valuation engagement because it's not value of a subject interest. This is a debt service analysis. We're not valuing the subject interest. We are determining a debt service analysis. There is no subject interest being valued in this particular illustration. Now note, the next example deals with a situation that would arise with any tax based on value, such as an intangible tax, a situation where the taxpayer must report a value on the return. In this illustration, we have a compliance filing that requires estimate of a value of the company. For instance, the market value of intangible personal property as defined by the state's taxing authority may need to be reported annually on a tangible personal property tax report. The client has a subject interest that is considered intangible personal property for purposes of this return. Member has been engaged to prepare the tax return. Do we have a valuation engagement? Well, it depends. If the state requires an estimate of the value of the subject interest and the estimated value requires use of professional valuation approaches and methods, then it would apply. However, if the client or a third-party appraiser provides the method, it does not. As well, it reminds you that the exception is not, the words not practical or reasonable to obtain or resolve the information could apply. Alternately, if the state follows more informal rules for the application of valuation approaches and valuation methods are not necessary, the statement does not apply. Again, the CPA would have to essentially comply. A professional judgment is used in computing the value. Now, the next example deals with allocation of basis based on fair value. In illustration 12C, we talk about the fact that we have to allocate value among assets, and it notes section 1060 and 338 may require the allocation of values based upon relatively value. Or in a partnership taxation, there may be allocations under sections 754, 743, and 734, and special tax basis adjustments for partnerships that may require an allocation among partnership assets. Are these types of allocations subject to the statement? The answer becomes primarily if the values of the intangibles or the potential subject interest occurs essentially solely based upon an allocation of the excess, kind of the leftover, let's say, the last class, and it says anything not allocated so far. We've been through non-subject interest all the way through our list of assets. Now we have one amorphous intangible asset at the back end to absorb the rest of the value. If that's how the value is obtained for the intangible, we don't have a valuation engagement, and SSVS number 1 does not apply. But if they're at the back end, we now have multiple intangible assets and we have to allocate among them. Now the standard will apply because we are going to determine the relative fair values of each of the assets. That means a valuation engagement has to be prepared on each of those assets so that we can then allocate the remaining basis among those assets. In that case, we would need to comply with the statement. Family limited partnerships are dealt with 12D, and the information in 12D is to illustrate. You can read that illustration. You're going to find out the key issue here is the CPA says, well, I'm not going to do valuation discounts, so therefore I'm not really doing a discount. I'm not really doing a valuation. And the answer in 12D is no, you're valuing a subject interest still. The mere fact you have agreed not to consider valuation discounts is irrelevant. You don't get out of it by merely saying, I'm not going to discount this. The statement applies if you determine the value of a flip or an interest in a flip. The application of value requires approaches and methods and use of professional judgment are required unless one of the exceptions apply. The mere fact you're not applying a discount doesn't pull you out of it. There's nothing magic about a discount applied to a flip that somehow says if you don't discount them, they're not being valued. They are being. They may not be properly valued, but they are being valued. Charitable remainder trust, 12E deals with that, require annual valuations. And the interpretation notes in Section 12E that the key issue in a CRT is what's the nature of the underlying assets. If there is a subject interest as an underlying asset, then we have an issue of having to value it. However, if it's all mechanical, it's like all marketable securities, then we're not exercising professional judgment. The rules will not come into play. So generally, if a CRT consists of a diversified portfolio of marketable securities, we don't have a problem. But if there's closely held stock or something other similar in there that could be an issue, then we will have to trigger this engagement. Partnership asset contribution rules are covered in 12F, where we have the basis differential under 704C. If one or more of the assets for which value is relevant under 704C on the basis issue is a subject interest, that is a business ownership interest, security, or intangible asset, and the client or the third party does not provide the valuation, then SSVS number 1 is going to apply. Illustration 12G notes cost segregation studies generally won't trigger this issue because there the things being valued generally are hard physical assets, not subject interest. That's a different set of rules. Section 12G points out that if a determined client qualifies for relief from the insolvency option, Section 108, you can end up getting yanked into an engagement subject to SSVS number 1. You've engaged to provide advice to a client regarding tax planning for income from discharge of indebtedness under Section 108. The company has advised the member the company will be able to negotiate a settlement in complete satisfaction of an obligation at 30 cents on a dollar. Is this engagement subject to the statement? The conclusion is it depends. Under Section 108, gross income excludes income from discharge of indebtedness only under certain circumstances. One of those circumstances is insolvency of the company. Under IRC Section 108D3, insolvency results from an excess of liabilities over the fair market value of assets. If the company must rely on the insolvency provision, not the bankruptcy, but the insolvency provision of 108, and one or more of the assets for which the value is relevant under Section 108 is a subject interest, so we have one of the interests that would need a valuation report, the company or third party does not provide that valuation to the member who's doing the tax work and the tax planning, and the member applies valuation judgment, then the statement will apply. Now, illustration 13 is a comprehensive example you may want to step through if you're doing estate tax returns, because it clearly notes the exposure to SSVS engagement as well as the number of assets that might exist in the estate. The basic outline of assets are found at the beginning of paragraph 13. Now, in illustration 13A, we talk about publicly traded stock that is traded infrequently. The statement goes on to note that if the shares are traded infrequently, that although the share is tradable for public sources, there is no definitive criteria to indicate when the statement applies to shares that are infrequently traded. A key consideration is the average trading volume of shares of TI Corp stock, which is our example stock here, on or around the valuation date. The concept of fair market value incorporates the notion that cash could have been received for the stock at the valuation date, and the share price of infrequently traded stock could decrease if a relatively large block of stock would be put on the market that date. So one of the indicators that we may have to do a valuation is if the shares are traded infrequently, so that we couldn't necessarily presume that the last quoted market price is one that could have been obtained. And that could trigger it. The other thing that could trigger it is B, if there is a large block of stock in a corporation, even if traded frequently, that block, the example we used of Bill Gates' ownership in Microsoft, could cause us to be triggered under this statement, because then the sale of those shares could influence the market. Trading volume, as you note, tends to be one of our key issues here. Trading volume, the size of the block of shares to be valued compared to the general trading volume would expect, has a big impact. Now, illustration 13C, though, makes clear that if you have a brokerage account considering as shares in various publicly traded companies, generally the rules are not going to apply. SSVS number one is not going to be triggered with your average Merrill Lynch account, simply because none of these shares and none of the positions in there are going to be significant enough to expect they would impact the market price if they were liquidated. Illustration 13D, though, makes clear that a closely held business changes it, and if with a closely held business, we would have to have SSVS number one generally is going to come into play unless we use an outsider to value the company or the client provides valuation. Now, illustration 13E is interesting because it goes on to talk about a partnership interest and comes to the conclusion that that's a valuation asset, but it does deal with a practical real-world issue. I have a decedent who owned 10% in a partnership. The managing partner isn't going to talk to me, and time is coming up to file the estate tax return. In that situation, the standard holds that in that case, it would be reasonable to hold it was impractical to perform an SSVS number one valuation, and you could basically not follow the standard and come up with a value because you have to file the estate tax return on the exception. Now realize though, be aware, you have to be careful not to pull the trigger too quick on not practical because of that footnote reference that if the client can give you reasonable estimates on these issues, you can use those estimates and still comply with SSVS number one. And if you can comply with SSVS number one, then you're supposed to comply with SSVS number one. Now, illustration 14 illustrates some of the issues that can arise from accepting values from a client or third party in lieu of performing SSVS number one, since that seems like, oh, that's a simple fix. We got it. Well, as it notes, if you have those, that's fine, except remember that if you're doing a tax return, SSTS number 3, certain procedural aspects of preparing returns, require you to perform certain due diligence with regard to those. So if the client gives you an off-the-wall number, while you may have escaped SSVS number 1 requirements, you may now, though, not be able to deal with the return due to the statements on standards for tax services that tells you you can't basically take the unrealistic position on return. Now, as well, the illustration makes clear a strong suggestion that if you're going to rely on the client for the value, you should make sure to document in your engagement understanding that the value is coming from the client and not from the CPA. Now, in illustration 15, we talk about where we use a third-party appraiser, where the CPA goes out and hires the appraiser. Client comes in, they have a subject interest, we say, oops, there's a subject interest. We go out and hire the services of an outside appraiser. Are we covered by SSVS number one? The answer is it depends, and it really depends on who that outside appraiser is reporting to. If that outside appraiser reports to the client, then we're relying on the use of, then basically that's a value provided by a third party. If, however, that third party does not report to the client but reports to us, then we have to adopt their work and consider the applicability of SSVS number one to the entire engagement. That may require us to perform certain services if the outside appraiser that we hired is not subject to SSVS number one because it's not a CPA. So be aware, it means that in most cases like this, you will want the client to retain the services of the outside appraiser and not you to retain them unless you're going to be willing to assure that the outside appraiser follows all the requirements of SSVS number one. You're going to basically stand behind their work. Now, illustration number 16 deals with the idea of a CPA getting creative and how that doesn't work. The client and member agree with the member will value a partnership interest and apply an average discount that the member is to determine based upon the results of various studies and case law. Does the statement apply, and if so, is this a calculation engagement or evaluation engagement? Conclusion, yes, the statement applies because the member determined the value of the partnership interest by applying valuation approaches and methods using professional judgment. This would be considered calculation engagement because the member or client agreed on specific valuation approaches or methods that we'll use and the extent of the valuation procedures the valuation analyst will perform. So we limited the application from evaluation engagement, but we still have a calculation engagement. Now, illustration number 17 makes it clear that we can have informal discussions with clients about estate or tax planning situations where the values could be discussed would be an issue without triggering the standard. And that includes if we have informal and conversation communication and writing with the client regarding the alternative tax consequence of gifting versus selling a business using presumption of a specific value, the standard would not apply. Key issue in this fact pattern, we use the presumption of a value. We don't determine and state that is the value. We have to have a hypothetical value to deal with this. Illustration 18 is one you should read if you're looking over the transfer pricing issues under 482. It illustrates the application jurisdiction exception. In this case, the example implies the overall IRS regulations on both performance and reporting for intangible assets would end up in total, virtually eliminating the applicability of SSVS number 1. But it's important to remember in other situations, if the rules are not comprehensive, where they are missing issues, you have to go back to SSVS number 1. In fact, this case, the illustration itself stops short of really saying that in the case of a transfer pricing study, that it does fully, basically get wiped out. There's no applicability. It simply suggests that so long as the results and the requirements are comprehensive enough, we've wiped out SSVS number 1. Now, finally, illustration 19 illustrates that all professional standards must be complied with. In a situation where the statement applies to members who determine the values part of tax engagements, would the member be required to be in compliance with the statements on standards for tax services? Answer, yes, as you might expect. You have to comply with both. All of the required issues have to be requirement. And realize, it cuts both ways. A CPA who is a valuation specialist is not exempted from SSTS number 1, is not exempted from Circular 230, paragraph 10.35, just as a CPA is not exempted from SARS 1's compilation reporting requirement if you manage to submit a financial statement. Now, many CPAs see themselves as specialists and they note their narrow specialty areas. I'm a controller. I'm a tax guy. I'm a business valuation guy, and believe they can ignore the standards applicable everywhere else. Reality is you are subject to all standards as a CPA, and every one of them can be applied. Every one of them needs to be applied if your work drops you into those areas. The final illustration, which is number 21, that's misnumbered in the one we have right now, because we go from illustration 19 to 21, and then the next illustration outside the tax area is illustration 20. Told that basically settlements or negotiations of values or offers in compromise or tax disputes fall under the settlement. No, settlements or negotiations of values and offers in compromise are part of a tax process. However, it notes if you prepare a valuation in preparation for a settlement or negotiation of value, so before we get started with the actual negotiations for settlement, we do a calculation of the value, and the valuation involves use of the approaches and methods and professional judgment, that valuation would fall under development aspects of the statement. The settlement or negotiation process itself is not a valuation. So I can go back and forth with the IRS representative and suggest, well, we could accept X, and he says, I want Y, and we say, well, we'll agree on Z. That's not a valuation, has to comply with it. But that initial valuation coming in, we do have to follow the appropriate standards. In addition, it notes the statement's reporting exemption for certain controversy proceedings would apply as evaluation performed specifically for the administrative matter. So we would have to meet the performance requirements for that initial estimation of value that we do internally, presuming we meet all of those requirements. We would not have to meet the reporting requirements, and when we're actually negotiating, no, we don't have to keep going back and applying SSVS number 1 every time we make an offer in the settlement arrangement. Now note, these engagements are effective January 1st, 2007. These rules are. For most CPAs, the issue is going to be in tax practice, you are probably not going to want to be issuing reports under SSVS number 1. So for you, the principal thing to be able to do is to identify when SSVS number 1 would apply, and to identify then that you need to disengage and what you cannot do or won't do because you're not going to trigger SSVS number one. It's the same thing as not wanting to trigger accidentally performing an audited financial statement. You don't want to accidentally trigger SSVS number one. For those who are not CPAs, it's going to be important to note that CPAs are going to become much more reticent to give you kind of off-the-cuff valuations. There's all kinds of issues that would suggest in the past CPAs may have been too apt to do such things, and that may have led to these standards coming down the pike. But going forward, a competent CPA should, if there's a subject interest, either make it very clear we're talking hypothetical and we can't rely on this value, or say, I can't do this, you're going to have to refer this out to a third party, or you've got to give me the value. So be very aware that the world's going to change for CPAs with the effectiveness of this statement. Now, this has been the Tax Update for July 4th, 2007. Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Be sure to visit them for information on tax matters and items of interest to tax practitioners who subscribe to their services. Again, they're on the web at www.lineburgservices.com.